Okay, so the title of my talk is Stable Non-BPA States in String Theory. It will be based mostly on these papers over here and also some work in progress. And let me just say at the beginning that throughout my talk I'll work in units where I'll set alpha prime equal to 1 and also of course h bar and c equal to 1. During the last few years, we have learned a lot about the spectrum of BPA states in string theory, which are characterized by the property that they are stable in most cases. However, many string theories also contain elementary string states, which are stable due to charge conservation, but are not BPAs. And the spectrum of these states at weak coupling, of course, can be found by the usual perturbative analysis. So if you are measuring mass in string metric, you have a Taylor series expansion in the string coupling constant, starting typically from a constant. What I'll do in this talk is to try to see what we can say about the masses and spectrum of these states at strong coupling. So the first example that I'm going to discuss is that of SO32 heterodic string theory, and it's perhaps the most familiar example. Now, it's well known that SO32 heterodic string theory contains in its spectrum states which are in the spinor representation of SO32, and these states are not BPA states. The simplest way to see this is that in 10-dimensional heterodic string theory, it's L equal to 1 supersymmetry, there are no central charges, and hence you cannot have massive states which are BPAs. Okay? These spinor states are massive states at weak coupling. But because these are in the spinor representation of SO32, it's also clear that the lightest state in the spinor representation of SO32 must be stable not only at weak coupling but at all values of the coupling, because there is nothing that it can decay into. And so the question that we will be asking is, what is the mass of this state at strong coupling, the state which is in the spinor representation of SO32? And this is one of the questions that we'll be addressing during the talk, but let me give the answer right away. So it turns out that if you measure the mass in the string metric, then the answer has the form of k, which is a numerical constant, times g to the half, where g is the heterodic string coupling constant. And you will see that there is an argument which actually determines the numerical value of k. However, this argument is not completely foolproof and is still in the process of development. Okay. But this form, as you will see, comes out in a quite concrete manner in this theory. The second series of examples that I hope to discuss, if I have time, is that of a Dirichlet p-brain on top of an orientifold p-plane. So, and here by orientifold p-plane, I'll always refer to orientifold planes of the SO2 type or SO2N type. Okay. So let's consider this as the orientifold plane, and let's just for the time being imagine that the d-brain is slightly away from the orientifold plane. So you have the d-brain and its image. Okay. And consider the open string that is stretched between the d-brain and its image, which I have denoted here by d'. Now, from this picture, it's clear that the classical contribution to the mass of an open string that is stretched between the d and d', it goes to 0 when the d' goes on top of the orientifold plane, simply because the length of the string goes to 0. However, one can show that in this case, the supersymmetric ground state of this string is projected out. So there are no massless states in this sector. Instead, the ground state which survives the projection is massive and not a BPA state. It's easy to see that this state actually carries charge under the SO2 gauge field that lives on the wall volume of the system. Okay. And the easiest way to see it is by representing this state in the quotient, okay, instead of in the double cover. So here is the representation of the same state. This is the orientifold plane, this is the d-brain as well as its image, and the string state that you are considering is where the open string starts from the d-brain, goes around the orientifold plane and comes back here. because during this process it reverses its orientation, we have the both the orientations going outwards from the deep brain, okay, which shows that it carries a total 2 units of charge under the deep brain wall volume gauge field. Because this is charged under SO2, it is again clear that the light state that carries this SO2 charge must be stable for all values of the coupling, because it cannot decay into anything else. And you can again ask the question that what is the mass of this state in the strong coupling limit. In the weak coupling, this state has a well-defined perturbation expansion starting from a constant and then parts of G. Again, before I go on, I'll give a summary of the results for this system in the strong coupling. So in this table I have listed here are the values of P, okay, which denotes the dimension of the brain that you are considering. The second column gives the mass measured in the string metric for coupling constant much larger than 1. And in the third column I have stated what is the overall coefficient that multiplies this is known or unknown. In this case it turns out that it is completely well defined and can be calculated. In this case there are some arguments which can determine the overall numerical constant, although it's not a foolproof argument. And in this case it's unknown. Unfortunately, in the case of the 3 plane on top of the orientifold 3 plane, I have no result so far. So there's a big question mark here. But you can always already perhaps see some pattern emerging in this column over here. Now, the reason that I have stated this result only for these 4 values of P is that if we consider the case where P is larger than 6, then the P plane orientifold plane system modifies the background around it so strongly that we cannot talk about an asymptotic coupling. Okay? Because what you find is that as you go away from the orientifold plane, the coupling does not have such a finite constant. So expressing the mass as a function of the coupling is not a meaningful concept. On the other hand, if you consider P to be less than or equal to 2, okay, then of course the coupling is well defined. However, in that case, the charged state has infinite self-energy simply from the integral over the field strength of the gauge field around it. Because F squared integrated over the wall volume of the gauge field gives you infinite from the infrared region, charge distance. And that's the reason why we have to be satisfied with only these 4 values of P. So let us now turn to example 1. Namely, we are looking for SO32 spinners in heterotic string theory in the strong coupling limit. And we want to see what is the mass of these spinners or how we represent these spinners in the strong coupling limit of the theory. Now, of course, you know that SO32 heterotic string theory in the strong coupling limit goes to weakly coupled type 1. So the question we are asking is really, what is the representation of the spinner states of SO32 in weakly coupled type 1? So to answer this question, we consider type 1 string theory compactified on a circle S1 of large radius R, and at the end we are going to take R to infinity, but for the time being let's just consider compactification on a circle of radius R. And now let's take a coincident D string anti D string pair wrapped on S1. Okay? Recall that we are considering coincident D string anti D string pair, although in most diagrams that I'll be drawing I'll denote them as if they are separated. So here is the D string, here is the anti D string, which is basically the D string with opposite orientation. Now we know that on the wall column of the D string there is a fermion field belonging to the SO32 vector representation, and those fermions come typically from open strings with one end on the D string, the other end on the 9 brain, okay, or other end with satisfy Neumann boundary condition. Similarly, on the anti-D string or the D string with opposite orientation, again you have the fermion fields living on its wall volume, okay, from these states. Okay. And now, as was shown by Polsinski and Witten, there is a Z2 gauge invariance on the wall volume of the D string and the anti-D string, which allows us to put either periodic boundary condition or anti-periodic boundary condition on these open string states. The periodic boundary condition gives a spinner state, antiperiodic boundary condition gives a scalar state, or state in the scalar conjugacy class. And these give state in the spinner conjugacy class. Okay. So now if we put these two together, okay, we'll see that we at least have a state with the right quantum number, because a spinor times a scalar of SO32 gives a combined state which is in the spinor conjugacy class. Okay. Furthermore, the bulk Ramon-Ramon charge that a D-string carries gets cancelled with the bulk Ramon-Ramon charge that the anti-D-string carries. Okay. So there is no bulk Ramon-Ramon charge carried by this system, and it belongs to the spinor conjugacy class of SO32. So at least we have got the right starting point. This state has the right quantum number. However, this description by itself is not too useful, because if we calculate the mass of this state, okay, simply by multiplying the D-string tension by its length, and there is a factor of 2 because there is a D-string as well as an anti-D-string, we see that this goes to infinity as r goes to infinity, simply because the length of the string goes to infinity. However, you have to remember that this is not the ground state of the system. And we do need to take into account the fact that this system, a D-string, anti-D-string pair, has a tachyonic mode. So here again I have drawn the D-string and the anti-D-string, and the tachyon comes from an open string that stretches between the D-string and the anti-D-string. One can easily show that the Nebuchadnezzar sector ground state of this system is tachyonic and is not projected out by GSO projection. So here is a tachyonic field living on the D-string anti-D-string pair. Now what is the boundary condition on this tachyon field? That is easy to determine. We simply cut the tachyon in the middle. We know that the upper half has periodic boundary condition, the lower half has antiperiodic boundary condition, and hence the tachyon, which is obtained by joining the two open strings, must have a boundary condition which is antiperiodic, okay, a product of a periodic and an antiperiodic boundary condition. So then we have the following picture. We have the D-string anti-D-string pair wrapped around S1. Okay. We have a tachyonic mode on this D-string anti-D-string pair, and furthermore we know that the tachyon must satisfy antiperiodic boundary condition as we go around S1. This then says that the ground state cannot be the configuration where tachyon goes down to a constant. Because if the tachyon had gone down to constant, which gives the lowest energy state, then that doesn't satisfy the antiperiodic boundary condition. Okay. And it's also clear from this discussion that the minimum energy configuration, at least when R is large, okay, is of the form where the tachyon starts from its ground state value minus T0, okay, then at some point it crosses over to plus T0 and goes to plus T0 as it goes to plus pi R. Okay. And as R goes to infinity, it simply becomes a soliton on the D-string anti-D-string pair. So let's now do energy computation again. Does this have finite energy, this configuration? Now that depends on the energy density far away from the core of the soliton. Okay. So the main question then is, what is the energy density far away on this side or on this side? That is given by the twice TD. Okay. Recall TD is the D-string tension. So because you have a D-string and an anti-D-string pair, you have twice the tension plus the contribution to the potential from the tachyon. And if this sum is zero, that would mean that this configuration indeed has finite energy, okay, because the integral gives you a finite answer. So you can see how the energy density will look like in this case, okay, which I have shown here. Okay. There will be a little bump of energy somewhere in the middle near the core, and as you go far away on both sides, the energy density simply goes up to zero. Okay. So this basically means that although we are representing this object as a soliton on the D-string anti-D-string pair, in fact far away from the core of the soliton, the D-string and anti-D-string has gone down to its lowest energy state, which is simply the vacuum. Okay. Because the D-string anti-D-string pair doesn't carry any quantum number, the lowest energy state of that is just the vacuum. Okay. So there is this little bump of energy here, which basically is responsible for the spinor state that we are looking for. So then the main question is this relation correct? Because this is what would give a finite contribution to the energy. And it turns out that this relation can indeed be proved under the mild assumption that a classical supersymmetric ground state of the system does not remain supersymmetric as you continuously vary the moduli of the theory. So if you make that assumption that the classical supersymmetric ground state does not always remain supersymmetric as you vary the moduli, then we can indeed show that this combination is indeed zero. Okay. Namely, that when the tachyon condenses on the D-string anti-D-string pair, you get simply zero energy. The contribution from the tachyon potential exactly cancels the tension of the D-string and the anti-D-string. So I'll not have time to go through the proof, but let's just simply assume that this is true and see what we get. Assuming that this relation is true, we can easily compute the mass of the string, the mass of this system, because the dependence on the coupling constant or the type 1 coupling constant simply comes as an overall factor of 1 over g tilde in the wall volume of the D-string anti-D-string system. Okay. And whatever you are left with is a simple numerical constant, which of course cannot be calculated directly in this method because that requires knowing the exact form of the tachyon potential, which we don't have. However, there is an indirect argument which I am going to go through, which gives us the value of this numerical constant as root 2. Okay, I'll just discuss how this comes. But at this point, you note that given this mass in the type 1, expressed in the type 1 metric as a function of the type 1 coupling, we can now convert this in the heterotic metric and express this as a function of the heterotic coupling constant by using the standard relation between type 1 and heterotic, and the mass turns out to be some numerical constant related to C times g to the half, as advertised, g being the heterotic coupling. Okay, so how do we determine C? Okay. So to determine C, we'll again compactify type 1 on a circle of radius r and take a D-string anti-D-string pair wrapped on S1, but this time we are not going to take r to infinity. Okay, let's do it on a circle of finite radius. If we do that, then and you use the fact that we are looking for a spinner state so that we have to put antiperiodic boundary condition on the tachyon, we see that this boundary condition means that we can expand the tachyon in its Fourier mode of this form, okay, x being the length along the D-string anti-D-string pair. And the Fourier mode involves only half integer modes because of this antiperiodic boundary condition. So this then says that the effective mass square of the n plus half mode is given by a sum of two terms. One is the contribution from the original tachyon mass, which is negative, and which in our normalization constant is minus half. But then there is a contribution from this momentum, which is n plus half whole square over r square. And now, by examining this, we see that there is in fact no tachyonic mode for if r is less than some critical radius, which in this case is 1 over root 2. Because if we set n equal to 0 here, and for r less than 1 over root 2, this always dominates over this, and hence all tachyonic modes disappear. So we'll be working mostly with the tachyonic mode T half, because that has the lowest mass square. So what is the interpretation of this? This in fact agrees with our physical intuition of what should happen. So for when r is large, in particular larger than 1 over root 2, then we see from the previous transparency that the tachyonic potential has a maximum at T half equal to 0, which means that there is another vacuum, which I'll denote by T naught, where the tachyon must condense. And this simply reflects the fact that for sufficiently large r, the total mass of the D-string anti-D-string pair, 2 times the length times the tension, is larger than the mass of the spinner state that we are looking for. And clearly, for r sufficiently large, at some point this has to overtake this, because this grows linearly with r, and we see that that particular r in this case is 1 over root 2. For sufficiently smaller, on the other hand, we do expect that the mass of the D-string anti-D-string pair will be less than the mass of the spinner state that we are looking for. Because clearly as R goes to 0, this side goes to 0. So at some point, this must be less than this. And that is what is happening for R less than 1 over root 2. Because the tachyonic potential has a minimum at T half equal to 0. 5 minutes, okay. So this then shows that the D-string, anti-D-string system is stable for R less than 1 over root 2. Now what happens at R equal to 1 over root 2? At R equal to 1 over root 2, this is massless, which of course follows from the formula that I wrote down earlier. But in fact one can show much more. One can show that at R equal to 1 over root 2, this represents an exactly marginal deformation. Which means that not only that the tachyon is massless, but the whole tachyon potential vanishes at this point. So then, if we plot the tachyonic potential against T half, it's flat. And this then means that the mass of the D-string anti-D-string pair, which is computed here at zero expectation value of the tachyon, is degenerate with the mass of the spinner state, which is sitting somewhere here, which basically is the continuation of this as you go to R equal to 1 over root 2 from above. Okay. So this potential, this minimum goes over somewhere here. Okay. So at this point we expect that the mass of the D-string anti-D-string pair is exactly identical to the mass of the spinner state that we are looking for. And this then gives us an explicit expression for the mass of the spinner state, because we know what Td is, 1 over 2 pi g tilde being the type 1 coupling, and R of course is 1 over root 2. So this gives you the mass of the spinner state as square root of 2 over g tilde. And if you compare the previous expression, we see that C in this case is root 2. Now there is of course a caveat here, because this derivation gives strictly the mass of the spinner state at R equal to 1 over root 2. What you are looking for is the mass of the spinner state at R equal to infinity. So the question that you need to address is, does the compactification on a circle affect the mass of the spinner state? Can we argue that this mass is indeed the same as the mass that you would get if we are an infinite radius? Now if, for example, this was an elementary particle, elementary string state, then this would automatically be true, because we are looking at a weak coupling of type 1. And the weak coupling limit, compactification does not change the mass of the state. If it has a regular soliton, then this would definitely not be true, because a soliton has large extent, and once you compactify, the mass of the soliton is expected to get affected. To say what happens in this case, we have to ask whether we can really ignore the interaction between the spinner state and its infinite number of images, which are placed at a distance of 2 pi over root 2 times n, n being an integer, because we have an infinite line of spinner states when you are compactified in a circle. Now we do not have a complete answer to this question, but we can do one thing, which is to compute the gravitational interaction, for example, between the spinner state and its images, and see if that interaction energy is small compared to the mass of the spinner state that we have found. So the mass of the spinner state is 1 over g tilde. So there is a product of two factors of 1 over g tilde. The distance is of order 1 measured in string scale. And the Newton's constant is of order g tilde square. So when you take the product of all these, you find that this is of order 1, which is much, much less than 1 over g tilde, which is the mass of the spinner state that we have found. So at least we expect that the gravitational interaction between the spinner and its images is not going to significantly affect the mass of the spinner state. And the same kind of argument can be given even for the electromagnetic interaction between these states. So perhaps there is some hope that this answer that we are getting here at R equal to 1 over root 2 at weak coupling indeed is the answer that we want, namely at infinite radius. So let me just conclude. I'll not have any time to talk about the P-brain system. So what you have done here is to identify the SO32 spinner state in type 1, as a specific soliton on the D-string anti-D-string system, and you have calculated its mass. Okay. The dependence of the mass on the coupling constant is quite concrete. It's insensitive to many of the details. The explicit computation of the constant requires some assumption. Okay. But perhaps what this tells us is that we should really look for the spinner states directly in the type 1 theory instead of going through this intermediate step of having a D-string anti-D-string system and then simply making the tachyon condense to make the D-string and anti-D-string disappear at two ends. Okay. Perhaps there is a simpler description of the state as some kind of D-particle in type 1, and some suggestion to this effect has been made by Bergman Gavardiel, but I have no idea right now how to construct this directly in this fashion. So I think I'll stop here.
Thank you very much. We have time for a few questions. Joe?
Your spinner state is roughly speaking a loop of D-strings.
Yeah.
The energetics are such that the size of this loop is not the
string scale. That's right.
You might have thought it would contract to something set by the D-string tension. There's some feeling as to why it doesn't contract, but the size of the string scale.
Yeah. See, that would happen, for example, if you use, the kind of picture that you are using is what you would get if you naively treat it as heterotic string, right? I mean, it's like if you have a fundamental heterotic string and you rate it contract, it's of the order of the heterotic string scale. And this is strong coupling. I mean, if you want to look at it that way, right, this is strong coupling theory. So I don't see how you can actually, do it that way, right, regarding this as a loop of these strings. Yeah, okay, so this is, again, I'm not sure that we should really trust the physical size that comes out of this. I think we should trust the mass formula, but the fact that the physical size comes out to be of the order of the string scale is probably just an artifact of how I have represented it. Because clearly its mass indicates that it's some kind of D object, right? It goes as 1 over G tilde. And perhaps there is a description in terms of D object which will make the physical size look much smaller than what it is.
Any other question? Okay, if not, let's thank Ashok.